The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Alongside that, you get a £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to a special Saturday edition of Coffeehouse Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. Now, you may have noticed this week on Tuesday, there was a special sight, if you went on social media, of St George's flags everywhere to be seen, particularly on Labour MP accounts. To discuss with me today patriotism in politics and whether Keir Starmer gets it, I'm joined by Tom Baldwin, former Labour adviser, author of Keir Starmer, First Official?
Authoritative.
Okay, we'll keep this discussion in and listeners can decide for themselves. And the author of the new book, England, Seven Myths That Changed a Country and How to Set Them Straight, along with his co-author, Mark Steers. Available in all good bookstores, right?
And lots of bad ones.
Okay, perfect. Tom, thanks for coming on. I suppose to kick us off, let's just get to that question, because some of these themes come up in your new book, which is, can Starmer do patriotism?
I think it's interesting. I think Starmer probably can do patriotism better than almost any Labour leader I can remember, including Tony Blair.
I suppose Tony Blair might be a higher bar, but I think if you think of Ed Miliband, Jeremy Corbyn.
Certainly better than them. Ed tried to do a big speech on England. I actually helped write it. But like lots of things we did at that time, it was a sort of briefly flared and then disappeared as we sort of scratched around trying to find a strategy. I think with Keir Starmer, it comes quite naturally. Probably more naturally, I think, even than Tony Blair. Tony Blair was a sort of global modernist, whereas Keir Starmer is someone who, in his sort of ordinariness, looks quite like England. And I thought what was really interesting about his message this week, and he did a video and he did an article in the Sunday Telegraph, was he wasn't talking about these big grandiose ideas of England. He talked about very ordinary things. He was talking about, you know, did mention the armed service, but he talked about the NHS. He talked about walking up Scarfell Pike with his disabled mother. He talked about belting out the Three Lions at Wembley. And this is quite sort of everyday Englishness, which I think is onto something. You know, fitting into the folds of this country is what politicians don't do enough. It's why this country doesn't like politicians. And if Keir Starmer can begin to resemble the country and show that he's reflecting the country back, I think the Conservative Party might have more to worry about than they think.
And I suppose some of this goes back to, or I wonder what you think, when do you think it's the first time we saw this? I think you could probably call it a pivot by Keir Starmer to talk more about patriotism, because, of course, we had the national anthem at Labour conference back in 2022. Members speaking to some members of the shadow cabinet after, and they were such, you know, silence, and they were just hoping no one interrupted, heckled or did something. And then there was huge relief when actually they pulled it off. But it felt like a moment of risk, which I think points to the fact that Starmer can have his position, but where the Labour Party is more complicated.
I mean, it was even earlier than that. In 2021, there was a row about putting the Union flag in the backdrop when he was doing, you know, videos and things like that. And lots of Labour people suddenly felt really uncomfortable about this. And now you don't even blink. It's become natural. And it's part of this process, I think, which Labour's going through, which is trying to say, you know, we've let the right of politics have all the best patriotic songs. And it shouldn't just be for the right. A country should be for everybody, or no one in particular. And US Democratic politicians think nothing about having stars and stripes. There's always been a bit of a sort of hang-up in the Labour Party about the flag. I don't think the flag is the be-all and end-all, but I think it's a symbol of the direction in which Labour's moving.
And if we go to your book, when you're looking at some of those myths, I suppose just talk listeners through what you're trying to do with it and then how it relates perhaps to Labour thinking.
Well, what we try and do is we take seven different places, each of them associated with a different myth which we think has been overly politicised, overinflated.
By the right?
By politics, largely. Yeah. Yeah, I think probably mostly by the right. Some of it by the left at times. There is a left-wing myth, you know, which Caroline Lucas talks about, you know, the levellers and the diggers and the Chartists and the suffragettes and the NHS. I think that's overinflated too, to tell the truth. What we do is try and bring them gently back to earth. Every country needs stories, and stories are important. But what you don't want is them to be so overly inflated they get in the way of people making progress. So we give lots of examples, you know. So the first place we go to is Runnymede, and this idea Daniel Hannan wrote about it, that we invented liberty. But we didn't.
He invented it.
I think liberty's always existed while people have been enslaved. It exists in people's imagination, wherever you are in the world. And it's not a sort of English birthright. Magna Carta is part of a very long process which contributed to ideas about false imprisonment and so on. But there's a whole myth about Magna Carta. Everyone knows that a lot of the stories about Magna Carta are exaggerated. What happened in 2015 with the 800th anniversary is suddenly, you know, we'd never built any memorials to Magna Carta in Runnymede. They all started sprouting up. David Cameron paying for this massive Magna Carta party because he was playing around with Euroscepticism, this idea that somehow English liberty was threatened by the European Court and the Human Rights Act. Well, it didn't end well for David Cameron. It ended with Brexit, which many listeners of this podcast would doubtless support. But I think it's one of the ways in which the overinflation of myths has distorted our politics.
And I suppose one of the issues, I think in the past when people have thought Labour's not sufficiently patriotic or you hear the Tory attacks, is the sense of being a bit embarrassed with the past. So, for example, you will have, and obviously it's much more complicated than a flag or what you think about Real Britannia at the proms, but these things are seen as indicators. And there's a feeling that Labour will, as a stance, often will be a bit more apologetic by the past, whereas the Tories will be more forward of that. How do you think that fits into this?
Well, it depends what you mean by the past. Yeah. So there's an accurate version of what happened in the 16th century with Francis Drake and the Armada and conquering other countries and the slave trade, which we actually need to come to terms with. And I think it's not about rewriting history, it's about trying to learn history properly. And, you know, I think the left have been quite good at that. What we shouldn't do then is reject this idea that England has a story about the wind and the sea. We have this great maritime history, flawed, checkered, but it's a very long and interesting maritime history, and we have a very long coastline. So what Mark Steers and I propose in the book is, if you want a relationship with the wind and the sea, rather than going on about global Britain, we should think about floating wind farms. That's actually about addressing a challenge of today rather than trying to recreate some glory from the past.
One of the ways that often patriotism comes up is in relation to football and sporting England. Do you think this is an area where Keir is going to push at? Because he seems to be much, and you, I think, noticed this in your previous book, but, you know, he seems quite comfortable talking about football, but no one actually necessarily buys that.
There's a whole section in that book called Footballism.
Yeah.
Because... Yeah, one of his friends actually says, yeah, most politicians pretend to like football in order to appear more normal. Keir probably has to tone it down because his football support is pretty obsessive. I think it does come very naturally to him. And I think what's happened to football is really interesting in that it used to be this vehicle for the most insular, hate-filled version of our country. And when John Barnes scored his goal against Brazil in the Maracanã Stadium in 1982... one of the greatest goals ever scored by someone in England shirt, the National Front supporters on the plane back were singing, "We only won 1-0, because goals by black players didn't count. Now, the England players take the knee, the England team is seen as a symbol of inclusion, and football clubs all over the country, you go to Wolverhampton, you know, the place where Enoch Powell represented for 35 years, and the club there is reaching out to every community. There's now a section of fans called the Punjabi Wolves, and they bring their doldrums to games. And I think it's fantastic. And it shows that football, which used to be just a symbol of hate and insularity, is now a symbol of inclusion. Well, I think that's progress.
Yeah, it seems to me as though if you're looking for what might, people might call, you know, we've got progressive realism, that's the latest Lamy attempt at foreign policy, and then we might have progressive patriotism at some point, which... if you do think about the England team and how in the past I think they've been quite critical of some of the politics of the Tory government, you suddenly move into a place where if Keir Starmer could almost attach himself to that, it would become a place that would make probably the Tory party quite uncomfortable.
Well, I mean, some people have compared Keir Starmer to Gareth Southgate.
I once compared Theresa May to Gareth Southgate. So.
And how's that working out?
Well, I think they merged the two pictures in a column in the iPaper. It was a bit much, actually.
Gareth Southgate kept his job for longer anyway. I think he'll probably go after the next tournament. But he is not a showy figure. He's not someone who takes postures, someone who listens. Keir Starmer's actually talked to him about management techniques and says what's really interesting is how he doesn't try to dominate a room, tries to learn from the room. And I think that's a sort of gentler version of leadership, one which, you know, people wear a little bit more lightly. Again, I think it's quite attractive. Now, this whole question about Keir Starmer's brand is going to go on and on. I think he almost needs to have more confidence in the sort of innate person that he is rather than trying to be someone more classically leaderly. To extend the football metaphor, Gareth Southgate shouldn't start throwing teacups around at half-time. That's not who he is. So he shouldn't pretend to be someone he's not.
Now, of course, when it's pretending to be someone you're not, one of the biggest criticisms of Keir Starmer is that he said some things and he said a very different thing, which would be conflicting. And we can argue it's a journey. But on this, I mean, do you think there's any contradiction in the Keir Starmer who took the knee and the Keir Starmer who now tells all Labour MPs to waive the George Floyd? Do you think they are things that can actually merge?
Yeah, the England players take the knee.
Yeah, but do you think where Keir Starmer is, it feels to me in his take the knee stage, mm-hmm. he was probably in an area where I think on lots of culture wars, if we use that phrase, area and others, he was where he was on trans and so forth. It was a slightly different place, whereas I think where he is now, whether it comes to the CAS report, whether it comes to what he says on protests and so forth, it feels a bit more to the right, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think probably that you could say that. I don't think Keir Starmer's bound to particular rigid ideology. I think he does have values. I think they're fairly strongly held. I think if you asked him about England players taking the knee, he would still support that now. But, you know, he kind of bends like our sort of English road system. It's not like always straight lines. I think politics sometimes demands straight lines and dividing lines. And just to bend and adapt and change your mind like ordinary people do, it's no bad thing.
And just finally, coming back to the book, I think if we're now, you know, for listeners who, of course, are about to buy it, having heard this podcast.
I mean, droves heading to bookshops. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. You might, like Liz Truss, have to do a further print run. what do you think, I suppose, from working on that book and travelling around the country, you know, if you were giving advice to a government, perhaps an incoming Labour government, were the biggest takeaways in terms of kind of what surprised you on that journey?
I think we've had so many big, grandiose ideas of nationhood or what England is imposed from on top, you know, whether it's global Britain or the invention of liberty or moral superiority or England alone or modernity. What we need to do is just relax into being English. It's a muddle. It's confused. It's complicated. That's actually what I like most about it. And there isn't a single version of England. My version of England is probably not the same as yours. And that's the beauty of it, that we all find a way of knocking around and living with each other nonetheless. And in that adaptability, in that ambiguity and nuance, is the place where we can find a new consensus, rather than trying to impose some big idea on everyone.
Thank you, Tom, and thank you for listening.
Thank you.